American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt only began to take Hitler seriously in September of 1938, after the Munich Agreement allowed Germany to dismember Czechoslovakia without a declaration of war. At the same time, however, American public opinion was sharply divided, with one out of three Americans sympathetic to the plight of Germany, the underdog in the First World War. This rift in America was a boon to Hitler, and he boasted that the United States would never again go to war to rescue the old powers of Europe. In this, Hitler made a fatal miscalculation. So after Munich, 3.5 long and blood-stained years would pass before his armies faced the force of American guns. By the autumn of 1939, Adolf Hitler was ready to deliver the blow that would plunge the continent of Europe into war. At dawn on September 1st, he unleashed his army, the Wehrmacht, on Poland. Conquest was swift and brutal. This was the Blitzkrieg, the lightning tour, designed to spread the terror among the weak nations of Europe, forcing them to surrender. Unlike the Czechs before them, the Poles resisted Hitler, and they paid with Polish lives. Within a few weeks, their nation was beaten, broken, overrun. While Hitler boasted of conquests yet to be won, in Paris, in London, and in Washington, the hour of decision had come. With memories still fresh of the last war in Europe, the United States chose to hold back, while England and France, honoring their treaties with Poland, declared war on Germany. The Nazi response was immediate. Dreaded German U-boats swarmed into the North Atlantic to prey upon Britain's merchant marine, the lifeline of the nation. On the first day of the war, the passenger ship Athenia was torpedoed and sunk at the cost of 112 British lives. Stalin, meanwhile, publicly praised Germany and, with Hitler's secret consent, attacked Finland in November of 1939. The Finns battled fiercely, but in 4 months they were obliged to surrender. And while Russia occupied Finland, the Norwegians steeled themselves for invasion by Russia's ally Germany. In April 1940, this invasion came, the scream of planes and the thunder of heavy bombs, as a nation whose only offense was that it lay in Hitler's path was ground under the conqueror's boot. With Norway secured, Hitler ruled the North Sea, and he was now ready for Holland and Belgium. Violating the treaties of neutrality that protected the small nations in its path, the Wehrmacht routed the Belgians and the Dutch, pounding their cities with superior firepower and overwhelming their defiant but hopelessly outnumbered defenders. In less than a month, the Dutch countryside was littered with dead, and the governments of Holland and Belgium had fled into exile in London. On the day of the invasion of the Netherlands, Prime Minister Chamberlain of England was forced from office to be replaced by Winston Churchill. Words the world would remember, Churchill told his people he had nothing to offer them but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. While to Hitler, he had this to say.
You do your worst, and we will do our best.
Germany's worst was yet to come, and so was Britain's best. France, unready for war and reluctant to fight, quickly gave ground under the Nazi assault. In late May 1940, outgunned, outnumbered, and heavily bombarded, the British defenders of France fell back to Dunkirk. Then, with the Royal Air Force flying protective cover, over 300,000 British and French troops are rescued by a makeshift armada made up of almost every available ship afloat. For the wounded and the weary, it was no longer a question of honor. Retreat was the only way out. While Hitler's troops regrouped for a final assault on France, the rescue fleet steamed homeward, bearing the best of Britain's fighting men back to England empty-handed. Arms, artillery, tanks, all were left behind. And while the survivors were thankful to be alive, the end for France and for England now seemed only a matter of time. Eager for easy prey, Mussolini attacked southern France while the Germans pounded the north. In desperation, France appealed to the United States, but the U.S. refused to be drawn into the war. And while refugees fled from the Nazi terror, choking the roads to the south, Paris fell to Hitler's troops. A silent city whose gaiety and laughter would be stilled by four long years of German occupation. It was Hitler's crowning triumph, the fulfillment of a dream. At Compiègne, northeast of Paris, a humiliated French delegation received Hitler's terms of surrender. It was June 19th, 1940. At the end of the First World War, in the same railway car, the Germans had surrendered to French commander Foch, who had demanded stiff payments from Germany for the damages caused by the war. But now it was Hitler's turn. While many French leaders had fled, others who remained behind welcomed the occupation, preferring peace on Hitler's terms to the death and destruction of war. But the conditions imposed upon France were crippling. The nation was required to pay 400 million francs a day during the occupation, while turning over to the conquerors two-thirds of its land and 80% of its natural resources. In addition, French Jews and other undesirables were to be surrendered to the Nazis. As allies of the Germans, the French were permitted to govern their people from Vichy in the south, though their army and their navy were now under German control. The overseas possessions of France were to be divided among the Axis powers, with Indochina presented as a token of gratitude to Japan. Hitler, it seemed, was unstoppable. In 9 short months, he had seized control of almost the whole of Europe. And now, with France on its knees, he was ready to finish the job. While a band played Germany's national anthem, Hitler pranced on the soil of France, savoring the revenge that many of his countrymen had longed for since their defeat in the First World War. Hitler promised the French that his troops would remain in France only as long as England continued to wage the war. And on that day in 1940, both the Germans and the French were certain that England would soon surrender. But though England was now alone, she refused to accept her defeat, and Germany attacked. In its island domain, England would be tougher to conquer than France, and in an attempt to bring the British to terms, Hitler hurled his planes across the Channel to engage the British Air Force above the English coast. Though the Messerschmitts were faster, the Spitfires flew rings around them. And in September 1940, Hitler intensified his raids on the city of London. In Churchill's immortal words,
"The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty. So bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for a thousand years, men will still say, this was their finest hour."
Radar, a new invention, was used for the first time to warn the waiting city. And then they came. Raining tons of bombs night after night upon the historic heart of London. Under the nightly onslaught, over 40,000 civilians lost their lives. England countered at once with punishing raids upon the German cities, and the firestorm gathered frenzy as two civilized nations sought to bomb each other to ruins. Though the bombing caused terrible damage, the Battle of Britain was Hitler's first major setback of the war. For England emerged from the Blitz with redoubled resolve to see the war through to the bitter end, no matter the cost. Churchill vowed that his people would fight in the fields, the streets, and in the hills, and they would never surrender. While the nation mobilized, the royal family shared their burdens. And when, at the height of the bombing, thousands of children were sent to the countryside, Elizabeth and Margaret went with them, symbols of British courage in a dark and desperate time. Though America still refused to join the fight, even to rescue England, President Roosevelt in September of 1940 quietly placed 1 million men under arms.
"The Congress has debated without partisanship and has now enacted a law establishing a selective method of augmenting our armed forces. The method is fair. It is sure. It is democratic. It is the will of our people."
In a public drawing, the names of the draftees were chosen, the first Americans ever to be conscripted into the military in peacetime. The shift away from neutrality had begun. Though in contrast to the First World War, few American men looked forward to the fight. While bombs fell in Europe, democracy was on display in America. High spirits and old-fashioned hoopla launched the 1940 Republican and Democratic presidential campaigns. Wendell Willkie, the Republican's choice, warned the voters of the perils that promised to destroy the nation.
Help me! Help me! Help me save it!
In the shadow of war, the voter turnout was the highest in the nation's history. Trusting that FDR could keep them out of the war, Americans returned him to office for an unprecedented third term. But the war in Europe drew nearer every day. By the spring of 1941, Germany's Air Force had turned away from Britain and was striking south in a bid to seize control of the Mediterranean. The target, the tightly held British stronghold on the Greek island of Crete. Lacking in sea power, Germany played its strongest hand, launching the most massive airborne invasion in history. From bases in occupied Greece, thousands of German paratroopers were dropped on Crete in a lightning raid calculated to take the British defenders by surprise. Germany's fighting machine had lurched behind the plodding trench warfare of the First World War. This was a blitzkrieg in action. And the fast-moving air and ground assault had steamrolled over nation after nation in Europe. Encircled, outmaneuvered, and alone against the German onslaught, the British held on for 11 grim days, evacuating 17,000 men, while the death toll on both sides of the struggle climbed into the tens of thousands. Though even Hitler was staggered by Germany's losses, Crete was overrun by the 1st of June. The Aegean Sea became a German lake. Meanwhile in Russia, Stalin was growing increasingly wary of his Nazi ally, and across the western frontier, hurried preparations were made for a German invasion. Invasion came in June 1941. Defending their native soil against the full force of the Wehrmacht, the Soviets, tanks with tanks, engaging the Germans in what would be the bloodiest campaign in human history. This was to be no lightning war, but a gruesome exercise in horror, which in 8 months would cost each army over 1 million lives. It was a fatal miscalculation for Hitler, for it drove Stalin into an alliance with Britain to crush the Axis powers. August 1941. The conviction that Hitler must be stopped by the Churchill and FDR together to plan a more active American role in the war. October 1941. Japanese Premier Konoe was forced to resign as pressure mounted from the military to seize all of Southeast Asia. His replacement, General Tojo, was committed to the path of conquest. Now, through the tripartite pact signed with the Axis powers, Tojo was ready to divide the world with Hitler. Back home, war still seemed far away. Stud Williams of the Boston Red Sox batted in the runs during the 1941 All-Stars game. For millions of Americans that bright autumn day, the threats from across the sea were easy to ignore. But FDR had warned Japan to abandon its plans for an empire. And on December 7th, 1941, Japan sent its reply. But encouraged by Hitler, Tojo unleashed a surprise attack on the U.S. base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Advanced warning reached Washington a few hours before. The command at Pearl Harbor was unprepared for the attack, and in two terrible hours, 2,300 U.S. military personnel were killed. America was stunned, and FDR responded in words of outrage.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
While Japan's leaders planned to force the United States to surrender power in the Pacific, they had drastically misjudged the mood of the American nation.
I ask that the Congress declare that since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
The die was cast. America was at war. Germany and Japan had both assumed that the United States would stand by while they overran Europe and Asia. But even before the raid on Pearl Harbor, FDR, through Lend-Lease aid, had cast America's lot with the Allies. The result was inevitable. After that day of infamy in December 1941, all talk of neutrality was stilled. For America, it was now a contest of military might, with victory to the stronger.